This is an ABC podcast.
Ta-lover-lover, warm Pacific greetings and happy Friday. This is Pacific Beat with me, Talia Olatia, coming to you from the land of the Wurundjeri people. Today on the show, what's the secret to a successful vaccine campaign in PNG? Some marketing experts share their thoughts on how to get the country to roll up their sleeves. And today, the centenary tournament is launched in Tonga, marking 100 years of rugby union in the country. You'll hear what they have planned in around 30 minutes. And of course, it's Friday, which means it's the Friday Forum, and we're definitely bringing the Fijian representation today. So stick around for all the hot takes from the 679. But first, what might Australia's nuclear submarine deal mean for the Pacific?
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Australia's new submarine fleet is set to turn nuclear in a bombshell announcement made yesterday as part of a major new security deal with the US and Britain. The new defence pact was negotiated in high-level secrecy and is one of Australia's most significant defence strategy changes in years, and one that analysts say is clearly aimed at countering China's increasing militarisation in the Indo-Pacific. But Pacific anti-nuclear activists are not happy, and experts predict tensions in the region will rise. Our reporter Jordan Fennell has the story.
It's the story on everyone's radar. Australia's Navy will be armed with a fleet of nuclear-powered submarines thanks to a new defence pact with the US and the UK.
We have entered, no doubt, a new era.
It's the most significant change in Australia's defence and strategic direction in decades. Nuclear-powered submarines stay quieter for longer than diesel generators, a big advantage if you're trying to stay undetected by an enemy. The US, China, Russia, France, the UK and India all have them. But the response from New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern has been swift.
Our legislation means that nothing that is wholly or fully powered, no vessel that is wholly powered by nuclear energy is able to enter into our internal waters.
Both New Zealand and Australia are party to the Treaty of Rarotonga, which establishes a nuclear weapons-free zone in the South Pacific. The legacy of nuclear testing in the region is strong.
Like a ball of fire lighting up the sky, the bomb shoots upward in purplish clouds of smoke, soaring to a height of 30,000 feet.
With many people in Marshall Islands still plagued by health and environmental issues after the US conducted weapons tests in the 1940s and 50s, Prime Minister Scott Morrison says nuclear-powered submarines won't extend to nuclear weapons and that Australia will meet all of its nuclear non-proliferation obligations. But Joey Tao, a campaigner with the Pacific Network on Globalisation, is worried about the optics.
Kind of contradicts what it has continued to commit to the Pacific in terms of ensuring it is a nuclear-free zone.
Rhea Moss-Christian chairs the Marshall Islands National Nuclear Committee and says the timing of the announcement is unfortunate.
That it comes at a time when the region is steeped in discussions with Japan over the Japanese government's plans around Fukushima wastewater release into the Pacific.
She says when it comes to nuclear matters in the region, Pacific countries should be consulted.
Not only the Marshall Islands, but Kiribati and French Polynesia. Of course, we have nuclear legacies that we're still contending with. And so for the benefit of regional partnerships and maintaining good relations, I think consultation is always a good way to go.
It's unclear if any Pacific countries were consulted, but Fiji's Prime Minister Frank Bainimarama is on Mr. Morrison's list of leaders to call now that the announcement has been made. The new deal replaces a $90 billion contract that Australia already had with France to build 12 attack class submarines. And journalist and researcher Nick McClellan says now this could mean tension between the two countries.
On the 31st of August, just a couple of weeks ago, the Australian and French foreign and defence ministers held a joint meeting. They pledged Indo-Pacific cooperation based on shared values, interests and principles. And I think the French feel betrayed.
And Anna Powles from Massey University's Defence and Security Centre believes that tension could extend to New Zealand and the Pacific.
Australia is now very much playing in a different league to New Zealand. So New Zealand will really need to manage up its relationship with Australia to ensure that New Zealand is still strategically relevant.
The submarine's main task will be to counter threats in the Indo-Pacific. And while the government hasn't said it, analysts say it's all about deterring China, who have been expanding its military at a rapid rate and building warships at an unprecedented speed. But Anna Powell says Pacific leaders have already been dissatisfied with how they're viewed when it comes to discussions around militarization in the region and Western allies countering China's influence.
There has been a long-standing criticism from Pacific Island leaders that they are seen as pawns in this great game, in this geostrategic competition between the US and China and between Australia and China.
The submarines won't be in the water for many years still to come. But in that time, campaigner Joey Tau says Australia should be focused on spending money on the issues that the Pacific is really concerned about.
This is not a priority of the Pacific. Climate change, it is. And if it's serious about being a big brother in the region, and if it's serious about its step-up program, it needs to put its money where its mouth is, and that is climate change and other issues.
That was campaigner Joey Tau from the Pacific Network on Globalisation ending that report. And overnight, France's foreign minister described Australia's decision to cancel the $90 billion submarine deal with France as a stab in the back.
Pacific Beat.
This week, Papua New Guinea donated 300,000 COVID-19 vaccines to Vietnam, as they would have expired at the end of the month without being used. And that's because PNG health authorities are continuing to struggle to convince people to get the jab. So far, less than 1% of the eligible population is fully vaccinated. The head of PNG's vaccination task force admits its publicity campaign has not worked. So how can more people be convinced to roll up their sleeves? Liam Fox spoke to a couple of communication experts to try and find out.
According to the latest figures, only 45,000 people out of the 4.7 million Papua New Guineans that are eligible for COVID jabs are fully vaccinated. That's less than 1%, one of the lowest rates in the world. At the National Control Centre, Api Kasman heads the Vaccination Task Force and admits their public information campaign has failed.
Certainly, it hasn't worked.
He says they underestimated the need to tailor health information for each of the 22 provinces.
We had almost a broad communication strategy that we thought would work once we just roll it out. Our problem was, you know, every province is like a different country, and we really need to tailor communications to suit its different area.
So why hasn't it worked? Emmanuel Narakobi is the director of Masalai Communications and has been a prominent commentator on PNG's social media scene. He's also one of the small number of people who are fully vaccinated.
Vaccines themselves are not a new form of dealing with viruses and diseases, polio vaccine. So this is just another disease and another attempt by mankind to deal with a medical problem.
He believes the high level of vaccine hesitancy is based on what he calls several layers of distrust.
There are ones that are bordering on sort of religion, like, you know, God didn't intend this to be this way and everything. And then there's ones down the path of constitutional rights. And then there's ones where you're unsure. But if our medical institutions or if our government, in a sense, was organized and prepared in a way that made them feel that, you know, they could trust the system and what was going on, then they would go ahead with the vaccine.
Tasman Samuel is the general manager of strategic communications firm Colony Group, which has handled campaigns for some of PNG's most well-known businesses. He points to rampant misinformation on social media as a big factor in the low uptake of vaccinations.
That creates fear more than anything because of the unknown. Effectively, what that means is that our citizens don't have the opportunity to make informed decisions due to incorrect information.
Among the many conspiracies are that COVID vaccines magnetise recipients, that they make men sterile, and that they are fatal after 2 years. Despite their apparent influence, Mr. Samuel believes it would be a waste of time and energy for authorities to respond to every one of them.
It's the energy conversation, right? Do you waste your energy debunking these myths, which are totally preposterous and absurd, or do you conserve your energy and then do it in awareness? If the awareness is correct, then they would just fall apart, right? It's a process of elimination. It doesn't do these things. If you were to go one-on-one with every single claim, you'd be here for the next year.
So how do you convince people to roll up their sleeves? Emmanuel Narokobi reckons you start with the low-hanging fruit, people who are not vehemently opposed to the vaccines and who just need a little push to get the jab. Then they can spread the word to their peers.
One example that I saw of that was a campaign was organised to set up a big tent outside the main Vision City Mall here. But that was done in the afternoons and over the weekend, and that drew quite a lot of people. So it seems like there was a certain amount of people there that just needed the convenience to be able to get the vaccines done.
For Tasman Samuel, it's all about data. Authorities need to get accurate data on who's holding out, where and why, and target those populations. Then get trusted local leaders on board to help convince them, particularly in rural areas where most people live.
Government's doing its part through the NCC to get information out. It's how far that information goes is probably where the challenge is. Is the reach and the coverage of the correct information, and maybe the stakeholders in the rural areas to carry that message where the government doesn't reach, such as your churches, your family elders, the clan leaders, the tribal elders. I think that's where the conversation needs to take place.
Back at the National Control Centre, Arpi Kasman sees health workers as the key to get more people immunised.
While social media is definitely influential, our people want to get their information from healthcare workers, be it the clinics out there, be it their local GPs. Really, the influencers of our people are healthcare workers and people that they trust.
To do that, though, they're first going to have to convince more healthcare workers to get vaccinated.
Thus far, we've vaccinated up to, you know, you're looking towards 10,000 healthcare workers towards, but that's a, you know, that's of 25,000 approximately healthcare workers. So we still got a lot of work to do.
That was Arpi Kasman from PNG's Vaccination Task Force, ending that report from Liam Fox. We have Neville Coop, the director of Nandraki Weather.
Good morning, Tali. How are you?
I'm doing well. What's the weather looking like today, Neville?
So the dominant weather feature we have at the moment is high pressure that's popping up in the Tasman Sea. And another one that's been around for a while out to the south of the Cook Islands and French Polynesia, and they're keeping the trade winds nice and active across the tropics again today. The other significant weather feature we have is a deep low that this morning is passing over Auckland and much of the North Island. Quite a nasty system, bringing some bit of violent weather really to the North Island. So that low is going to move out over the Hawke's Bay region and into the South Pacific. Far South Pacific by tomorrow morning. So there's a front associated with that low. Now, that frontal system is just to the west of Viti Levu in Fiji, and over the course of today and tomorrow, that the tail end of that front, the very northern extremity, will just clip Fiji and also Southern Tonga as it pushes eastward. So they can expect some bit of unsettled weather and some showers and perhaps even a few thunderstorms over the next 24 hours or so. But for pretty much everybody else, it's going to be a nice weekend and lots of sunshine and just gentle trade winds.
That's what we'd like to hear. Have you got anything exciting planned for the weekend, Neville?
No, I'm in Australia at the moment, of course. So I'm going to spend some time with my granddaughter, lovely granddaughter, which is always nice. But other than that, it's quite a weekend at home. And just tracking a few other weather systems. It's still early days yet, but we could see some more cyclones north of the equator. It's still a peak summer up there. So just keeping an eye on what's going on up there, because we have had a fairly quiet season up there, and chances are we may have may go off with a bang in the second half of the season. So still a bit of time left for summer, but certainly in the southern hemisphere, it's looking much more spring-like now. So lots of humidity's up a bit and a bit warmer. And next a week today is the spring equinox. So that's another thing to note.
Yeah, absolutely. It sounds like a weatherman never gets to rest. There's always weather going on somewhere.
That's correct, yes. And in fact, my youngest son has a flying lesson today, so we're keeping an eye on the weather here in Australia as well. Hopefully it goes well for him.
Yeah, indeed. Well, Neville, thank you so much for the update, and we'll talk again next week. Have a good weekend.
Sure. Thanks, Sally.
Thanks, Neville. That was Neville Coop, the director of Nandraki Weather. And for weather updates at any time, you can always check out their Facebook page. You'll find them at Nandraki Weather. There is lots of news around today, and to bring us some of the stories is Liam Fox. Good morning, Liam.
Good morning, Talia. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you. We made it. It's always feels more exciting when, you know, you're doing the early starts and it just means early finish, longer weekend. You're like, yes, bring it on. Bring it on.
Yeah.
But you have some stories to bring us before you can do that. Let's go to Fiji first, where the country's successful vaccination campaign has led to the easing of some of their COVID-19 restrictions. What is easing up?
Yes, yesterday we heard about how Fiji had reached the target of 60% of its population fully vaccinated, and an announcement was foreshadowed that some restrictions would be easing because of that. Well, yesterday the Prime Minister, Frank Bainimarama, announced that the containment borders that are on the main island of Viti Levu, where the vast majority of cases and deaths have occurred, would be lifted, he said yesterday. And that has happened as of 4 a.m. this morning. That means that domestic travel is now open for the whole of Viti Levu. Domestic travel is open. That means that public service vehicles can operate at 70% capacity. Mr. Bainimarama said, however, that inter-island travel will remain highly controlled, and that includes to the other big island of Vanua Levu. From the 4th of October, all workplaces, educational institutions, churches, hotels, restaurants, cafes, cinemas, gyms and other venues will be able to open at 70% capacity, but only to fully vaccinated people. And to check that people are fully vaccinated, they're going to roll out what they've called a Vax Check tool that will allow for real-time digital verification of people's vaccine status. So venues will be able to use that to confirm the status of people wanting to come inside. Mm-hmm. Now, on the international travel scene, Mr. Bainimarama said that's still hoping to be done, reopened by November, and he gave some hints as to how that would happen. He said it would be a gradual, easy start with travellers from exclusive green list areas that have similar high rates of vaccination to Fiji. And good to know that Australia is on that list so far. Lots of Australians, including myself, will be hoping to get out to Fiji and the Pacific as soon as possible. That really will depend on how things are going here, I guess, primarily, and how our own COVID outbreaks in places like New South Wales and Victoria are going.
Absolutely, because I think that we would be
able to meet the, you know, the high vaccination rates, but we still have a lot of positive cases, which obviously can cause drama. We just need to see what's happening in New Zealand, because obviously those cases started from a flight in Sydney. But yes, fingers crossed, because there are lots of people who want to be able to go to travel to the Pacific. Let's go to Samoa now, where it was a relatively politically drama-free day yesterday, or at least it was a little bit more restrained than the previous few days. What happened?
Yeah, well, most of the action was in court yesterday. The party of the former government, the Human Rights Protection Party, led by the former PM Tui Laiepa, went to the Supreme Court to challenge the Speaker's refusal to swear in its 18 members who were elected to Parliament during that election all the way back in April. Yesterday afternoon, a three-man bench of the court ruled that the Speaker does have an obligation to administer the oaths of office to those members and is obliged to carry that obligation out forthwith. And looking at the live stream of Samoa's parliament this morning, the HRPP members have turned up. They are inside, so it looks like they will be sworn in this morning. We're still waiting for the speaker to take his chair. The bells are still ringing, so things are still to officially get underway. But as I said, it looks like that will happen this morning. And in fact, as I speak, the sergeant at arms is entering the building carrying the mace. So it looks like things are about to get underway. After that happens, it's not clear whether they'll go back to discussing the budget. We're hoping to pass it by the end of this week, but this swearing-in ceremony might push things out a little bit.
And now it seems like the drama is going to happen inside the parliament.
Yes.
I'm sure that will be very interesting, considering that, you know, now that the HRPP have the numbers to at least have a working opposition in Samoa, so it'll be very interesting to see what that means for democracy there. Finally, let's go to Tonga, Liam, where a man has been charged over a large and unusual drug bust. What's happened?
Yeah, this happened a couple of days ago, but I thought it was worthy of mention. It's unusual because a 45-year-old man in Tongatapu has been charged with exporting 30 kilograms of methamphetamines from Tonga to New Zealand. Normally, we see it coming the other way. Mm. We know that Tonga and the other Pacific Islands are a transshipment point for all kinds of drugs from places like South America, Asia, elsewhere, to New Zealand, Australia, and onwards to other markets. But this time it's come from Tonga to New Zealand. And according to police in Tonga, it was contained in a refrigerated food container and was seized in New Zealand last month. Five people in New Zealand have been arrested, and the one in Tonga that I've already mentioned. The Tongan man is due to appear in court on Monday. We're yet to see police comment about, you know, the significance of this. Do they have any idea of where it's come from? It's hard to imagine that 30 kilograms of meth was manufactured in Tonga, but geez, it'd be incredible if that was the case, if they think that is the case. Mm-hmm. And of course, drugs have been in the news a lot, and in Tonga a lot. This seizure follows the discovery and seizure by police of 14 kilograms of cocaine that washed up on some beaches in Tonga back in July. So drugs really are front and centre in the media in Tonga at the moment.
Absolutely. And of course, whenever we do a drug story, they're only the drugs that we know about. And that's not to say, you know, what it means for personal use as opposed to, you know, exporting it and moving it around. So obviously a great concern. Liam Fox, thank you so much for bringing us those stories.
My pleasure.
That was Liam Fox there with some of the stories making it news today.
Island Music brings you the finest reggae from Jamaica and around the world with a spotlight on the freshest Pacifica talent.
Join me, Rick Howe, for Island Music, a two-hour journey from the foundation of Jamaican popular music from ska, rocksteady, roots, dub and dancehall, plus the freshest new releases and a spotlight on emerging talent from around the Pacific.
Every Saturday with Rick Howe from 12 till 2 p.m. PNG time on Radio Australia across the Pacific.
You're listening to ABC Radio Australia's Pacific Beat program with me, Talia Olatia. A Papua New Guinean high school student is desperately trying to get back to his school in Australia in time for his final exams. Arian Makaya has been stuck in the PNG Highlands town of Goroka with his family since late last year. The teenager's attempts to be granted a special exemption to fly into Australia have been rejected four times, and his family has serious concerns for his mental health, as Georgie Hewson reports.
It was meant to be a memorable final few months of schooling, but Toowoomba boarding student Arian Makaya will probably only experience it through a computer screen. The 17-year-old, who spent more of his life boarding overseas in Australia than with his parents, made the difficult decision to return to Papua New Guinea amid the pandemic uncertainty in March last year. But he and his family never anticipated such a fight to see him return for his final year.
It's been a big struggle, both mentally and physically, just because the environment's completely different back here.
He's applied to be allowed back into Australia under a special Year 11 and 12 student exemption, but has now been knocked back four times. His father, Sunil Makaya, says it's ridiculous.
He's gonna spend the 14 days of quarantine in Australia before he comes out into the public. You know, he's gonna do all and test negative, hopefully, and not be an issue. I mean, Australians are returning into Australia every day and coming back.
He says his family holds serious concerns about Arian's mental well-being.
Psychological effect on him, you know, because he's been part of that system for this long, being away from his teachers, access to his teachers, access to his mates, or study groups, things like that have all affected him.
Arian says he was forced to drop down from advanced maths to cope with balancing his workload remotely, and also missed out on many practical lessons for his science subjects. Simon Lees is the head of school at Toowoomba Anglican School and says the situation was unacceptable. He says while they've tried to accommodate Arian, they haven't been able to replicate the value that face-to-face learning provides.
Academically, it will have a negative impact on him. There's no doubt about that. It's almost impossible to deliver the same level of curriculum to a student who's living overseas as it is when they're in our classrooms. We would want him at least to be able to spend some of his final year, you know, in school so he can spend those last, you know, month or so with his friends.
Arian's family has now engaged lawyer Dimitri Bourne, who blames the Queensland government for the predicament.
Asian have categories for an exemption. So if you're an immediate family member, you can get exempt from travel restrictions. If you have a business visa, you get exempt. Or if you're a year 11 and 12 students, you can be exempt. So there's a special category. And then there's a compassionate category for all other cases that don't fall within a category. But the exemption that we've been trying for is the year 11 and 12 category.
But Mr. Bourne accused Queensland Health of blocking their exemption.
Four exemption categories for a year 11 and 12 student. They ask for the state's assistance in granting these exemptions. So there's two departments that the Department of Home Affairs need approval from in the state. So they ask for approval from the school, which is the first step, and the school obviously supported and approved it. Then they ask for support from the Department of Health in Queensland.
His mother, Nix Makaya, says several other families in her community have been able to send their students back to boarding school in Australia. She says it's crucial for Arian to get back to Australia for the sake of his future.
He was wanting to get into medicine, and now he goes, "Mum, what if I don't get back in time to do these my exams and I don't get the marks and the grades that are required?" So his entire future is hanging right now.
That was Mother Nix Makaya in PNG there, Georgie Hewson reporting. And the ABC's put questions to Australia's Home Affairs Department, which is responsible for granting entry into the country, and to Queensland Health as well.
Pacific Beat.
Tonga will launch the centenary tournament today to mark 100 years of rugby union in the country. The event will feature eight men's 15s teams and eight women's 7 teams, four of those coming from Tongatapu and one from each of the outer islands. As well as a celebration, the games will also feature a Tonga-wide talent search, aiming to identify players who might represent the Ikale Tahi or Moana Pacifica in the future. At a cost of around $500,000, though, the tournament won't be cheap. Peter Harding, Tonga Rugby Union's chief executive, spoke to Richard Ewart.
It's been a fantastic effort, this, because it's been organised and is being run by board members. So they're up to their elbows in the work at the moment. World Rugby's put a fair chunk of funding in to make sure this goes well, and the government has put a fair chunk of funding in as well. So what we really have is everyone getting involved and assisting to make sure this goes as well as it possibly can. Hopefully we will run a very successful tournament. We can reflect on it and we can have a look at where we are and take stock.
The fact that everyone's pulling together to make this tournament happen, is that indicative that people generally involved in rugby in Tonga now are all pulling in the same direction, or is there still a little bit of work to be done on that?
There's always work to be done. Like, if people are pulling in different directions, it's not necessarily a bad thing. It's just that people have different opinions. Well, I think everybody wants to see the best you can possibly get for Tonga rugby. While there's a little bit of differing opinion now and again, what we want to do is make sure that we come out at the end with the best product possible. What we've got here now, if you look at it, is we're really trying to build a pathway. And we've had two good tournaments, one in Vava'u and one in Tongatapu this year. This is a centenary. And by the time this finishes, we'll have every senior player and every high school player or high school senior profiled by the end of the year. So we'll have a very, very good indication of who's here and who's going well. There's also an under 16 tournament on at the moment as well, run by the ministry. So we're profiling all the under 16 players as well. So it's going to add significant depth and weight to what we're doing with our pathway. So we'll know everybody who's here. And then, as I said, that'll make a real contribution to our understanding of it.
So as well as a celebration and a festival of rugby, this is basically an island-wide talent spotting exercise. Would that be fair?
This has been going on all our year. Samisi Fanu and Joe Fafita, our head of performance and our head analyst, have been working to make sure that everyone's profiled. We're using a system called Sports Guard to register all these players with all their details and all their metrics. And I would imagine that it is a talent spotting exercise. You know, like when people have been selected for a lot of things previously, there hasn't been this depth of knowledge of what they're actually doing in games or what their actual physical capacities are. So when we do select Tongarea and under 20s and people for the academy, which we hopefully set up next year, we'll have intimate knowledge of each of the players, so we'll be able to pick the best players regardless. Everything we're doing at the moment is basically talent spotting. No matter where people are in the world, we've got people everywhere looking for players. And this particular tournament, the Centenary Tournament, is going to have all the best players in eight teams playing each other. So it's going to be a great exercise for us because it'll be an increase in intensity from the local comps.
And as far as the men's game is concerned, could this exercise, this talent spotting countrywide, lead to one or two players who might be pointed in the direction of Moana Pacifica? I mean, have they been in touch with you at the Tongan Rugby Union? Because after all, that's what's supposed to be happening, isn't it?
We have calls with Moana. We're working out a pathway to the Moana Pacifica. We had another call with the islands the other day on how we can play each other and present players for selection towards Moana Pacifica. We have another call next week. It's a fortnightly call. And we're working together to make sure that the next generation of Moana Pacifica players are recognised well ahead of time and that they identify them as early as possible and start to contribute towards Tonga and Samoa, towards these people's developments. Yeah, and it's going very well at the moment.
Would that tend to suggest, therefore, that perhaps in season one, Tongan players who feature are likely to be New Zealand-based, but maybe season two, season three, some would come through from the islands? Is that what you would hope for?
That's our intention. And logically, you can't just take a kid from the islands and stick them straight into a Moana Pacifica program because there's a difference in levels. That's what our project is doing now. We're working out what the metrics are in local games and what they are in training, comparing them to Super Rugby, for example. We'll find a gap and there'll be a gap analysis. And then what we'll be attempting to do here is to bridge that gap through training and through increasing the ability of the coaches and then the increase the ability, the type of rugby they're playing in games. COVID's got a lot to do with what's happening in rugby at the moment. So logically, you look at Moana Pacifica, moving players around is very difficult at the moment. So they are tending to concentrate on players that are based in New Zealand. They've still got to get a squad out on the pitch. It'll be a good squad, but it's just the way it is with COVID at the moment.
That was Peter Harding, CEO of the Tongan Rugby Union, on the line from Nuku'alofa, and he was talking to Richard Hewitt. And while the Centenary Tournament has been specially organised for obvious reasons, the hope is that it will actually become an annual event.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
You are listening to Pacific Beat with me, Talia Olatia. It's now time for the Friday Forum, that time of the week where we ask guests to share their news stories from the week that grabbed their attention. And as is custom here on Pacific Beat, we've asked them to bring a rose, a story that made them feel good, a thorn, a story that, you know, really got them riled up, and of course, the banana, the story that made them laugh. Now, unfortunately, we can't get in contact with one of our guests, but luckily, the guests that we do have, Dr. Chiochi Ravulo, the Professor and Chair of Social Work and Policy Studies at the University of Sydney, has the personality of four guests, so I'm pretty sure you'll still be entertained. Nisa Bula Chiochi, and welcome to Pacific Beat.
Thank you for the introduction.
Also, no pressure now, isn't it? You're just like, you're going to have to carry this. Look, Chiochi, let's start with your thorn, because then it can just only go uphill from there. And it's about, like, lawyers calling for more police training when it comes to dealing with cultural groups. Tell us about the story and why you chose it.
Yeah, so it's a story that was reported earlier on in the week, and it was about the over-excessive force used by police officers when it comes to Aboriginal communities in Australia. And this is something that I can relate to also. This is one of the reasons why I actually went into social work. There's a higher proportion of Pacifica people in the legal justice system, and this really gets me going when it comes to this idea of creating equitable legal systems and legal responses that does provide scope to meet the needs of its community. That's when we're going to have more equitable approaches. But this news story just really gets me really angry, just in regards to how we're 2021, it's still happening.
Mm. And what's so crazy, especially about Pacifica populations, is that in Australia, it's such a small number of people who have Pacific heritage, and yet the number when we look into prisons is so much higher. And then, of course, our Indigenous populations absolutely overrepresented. And we even see that with the call to raise the minimum age, because the communities that continually seem to be affected, even though in terms of population numbers, they shouldn't have the high amount of numbers, are those communities, you know, those Indigenous communities, the Pacific and Māori communities. So I understand, obviously you went into social work to how passionate it is, but how important is it when it comes to cultural training that, you know, cultures aren't just treated as a monolith? Like, you know, even if we're talking about Indigenous cultures, there's lots of different communities that have different rules, different protocols. How important is that when you're even designing cultural training to make sure that it is acknowledging that, you know, not all brown and black people are the same?
Totally, Talia. And that's where a lot of the training that's now happening, traditionally we used to focus on this notion of cultural competence, this idea that you do a 2 or 3 hour course and all of a sudden you're competent to work with the other. So we're really moving more towards this idea and concept of cultural humility, which promotes cultural safety, this idea of workers, whether you be a health professional or a police officer, going into culturally diverse spaces and exercising cultural humility, where you strive to learn the diversity and its differences, how it operates and exists, rather than you training up to be an expert of the other. So I think that's something that needs to occur. We need to be more, we need to put more emphasis on this idea of cultural humility, which promotes that notion of cultural safety.
Absolutely, because I've been to many diversity trainings in my time, and after a while I'm like, is this just an annual requirement where we check a box, people ask for questions, we give our feedback, and then no one listens to it? So it's nice to see that the conversation might be changing into something where people, you know, are actually listening and acknowledging it. I could talk to you about that topic for forever, but let's go to our rose now, because I don't understand, Chiochi, how you are in Sydney and yet your restrictions are lifting when you have more case numbers than here in us in Melbourne. Like, I'm very happy for you that you get to move around, but I just don't understand it. Tell me what you are looking forward to and why this is your rose.
Well, I am in one of those 12 local government areas of concern, and so we've experienced tougher restrictions than other parts of Sydney. And so the other day when the Premier announced that the curfew which was only placed on those 12 LGAs of concern, was being lifted. And so the curfew was from 9 p.m. to 5 a.m. Yeah. It sort of excited me. And it's really, really interesting because the whole, obviously, lockdown experience in Sydney has been a journey in itself. And it's funny how something like so simple as lifting a curfew makes you feel happy. Mm. So, yeah, that is a level of joy I experienced this week.
And I know, Churchy, you've been doing Facebook Lives and, specifically talking to Pacific communities, especially there in New South Wales, about what's going on. What has been the vibe there in New South Wales? Because obviously we see, it feels like, when we see lots of people on Bondi not getting in trouble and then you see other people getting in trouble for much smaller things, it is a bit weird. What's your vibe on what's happening?
Oh, this is the start of a longer conversation, I think, Talia. One of the areas of research that I'm continuing to explore is this notion of whiteness and how whiteness permeates Australian society, the creation of us and them and the absence of the other. And so this is not me going off at white people. It's actually the opposite. It's about understanding the way in which the status quo is created by this dominant narrative that continues to create this us and them that doesn't include diverse ways of knowing and doing, being and becoming. So yes, I have a lot of thoughts on the way in which some of those policies and structures are created. Even the first story reflects this notion of whiteness and the need to ensure that we're creating more equitable approaches across broad society.
Mm. And that's the thing, isn't it? It's not like you have to be critical if you're white or feel bad about it. It's just acknowledging that, other people don't exist in the same privilege or have the same things that you do, and acknowledging that and finding ways to be like, let's make this more fair for everyone.
Exactly.
But again, another topic we could talk at length about. But I definitely do. Oh, we've got your second guest. I can hear a dog barking in the background.
Yeah, it's my lovely dog. She's doing the thing. Sorry about that.
No, not at all. Radio. Look, this is the thing. And during pandemic times, there's lots of, we've seen it on TV of, dogs and children interrupting live interviews. So it is very, very fitting. And weirdly, perfectly segues to the banana story of your week, because I've got to admit, this brought me a lot of joy this week. Tell me, I've also got the clip, and we can play that. But you tell me how you, as an audience, how you took in what happened.
So it's with Tony Armstrong on ABC News Breakfast, and he had a bit of a slip in his him presenting a particular story on a cricketer, and it was hilarious. Just, I think it was hilarious that he said it on live television, but it was also the response of his colleagues that made it even more funnier, because they looked just as uncomfortable with what's just been said. It was hilarious. And I still look at that clip and just crack up, laugh out loud.
Can I just say, it was shared to me so many times on so many different message groups. This is the clip that people who haven't seen it or haven't heard it, this is what happened.
Australian skipper Tim Payne is set to undergo neck surgery, but medical staff remain confident that the veteran will be fit for the Ashes. Payne has a bulging disc that has been causing him pain. I'm going to throw to you very quickly, Michael.
Bulging what?
Disc.
Disc.
I said disc.
That's what I thought you said.
Do you know what's really funny is every part of that, but obviously Tony Armstrong, delightful human being, got in a lot of, a lot of people were talking about it because it did bring us so much joy. And I actually saw him in the office the day after that. And before I could even say anything, before I could even open my mouth, he just pointed at me and he goes, "Shut up. I know what you're going to say, and shut up." And what was so great about it is that, one, he also thought it was hilarious, and he was like, look, we're in a pandemic. If I'm the one who has to keep providing, comedic entertainment, then I will do that. He will take that on for us. Two, how he was like, I had to acknowledge it when it happened because it was really funny. And three, it just goes to show that
I think no matter how old you get, there is always the immature child within you that will laugh when someone accidentally says a swear word on TV.
Oh, totally, totally, totally. I mean, if Australia didn't love him already, I think we're in love with him even more. And I think you're right, that idea of just stuffing up on live anything, like a barking dog in the background, where I'm sure you've experienced some faux pas in your live career, Talia. It just shows the humanity of it as well. And I agree. I think that breaks through, especially in the time of COVID.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, look, this week, I think at one stage, instead of saying version, I said virgin. And there has been another time where I accidentally called the show Pacific Beak instead of Pacific Beat. And my tech has never lived it down. Every time I do a bird story, he's like, should we play that out? You know, as a uni professor, have you ever done anything in front of your uni students that was embarrassing?
Yes, I said incontinence instead of incompetence. So I was referring to a particular process and I said incontinence instead of actually saying something else. So it's interesting. I think sometimes we do. And I've learned actually when I do things, especially when I'm presenting live, even doing keynotes, that I just have to roll with it and just sort of get on with it. And, you know, just the reality of being who we are. Mm. But obviously I embrace the sense of humour that goes with it too.
Absolutely. And it always shows that, you know, everyone is human and we all make mistakes. And as long as you can laugh at yourself, it's all good. Well, Georgie, that brings us to the end of the Friday Forum. I told people that you have the personality of four guests and I don't think anyone would have. In fact, it's probably lucky that our other guests didn't show up because we wouldn't have had time to fit them in anyway. But I hope you enjoy your newfound freedoms this weekend. And until next time, thank you so much for your time on Pacific Beat today.
Thanks.
Oh, and thank you to your dog as well. That was Dr. Chiochi Ravulo, Professor and Chair of Social Work and Policy Studies at the University of Sydney, joining me there for the Friday Forum, where really anything can happen. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat for this morning and for the week. Richard Ewart will be in the morning's chair next week, and you can actually catch me presenting the afternoon show. So we're going to be switching chairs. A huge thank you to everyone who worked so hard to put this show together this week. Liam, Jordan, Evan, Richard, Catherine, Caro, Nick, Priyanka and Anthony, and to our techs, of course, Elise, Chrissy, Jules, Ari and Selwyn. Also, thank you to you. I hope that you have a happy and a safe weekend. Whapatai le wha longalongu, manawia le aso.